Hello, I'm Joseph Lidster, and you're listening to a podcast of spurious morality. Try saying that after a drink.
Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston, and with me this week I have Gareth.
Hello.
And we are joined by special guest Joseph Lidster. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you. Welcome back.
Yes.
You're a first ever returning guest.
Oh.
So we've had some very wonderful people join us, but you are the first one to rejoin us.
Does that make me special or cheap? I don't know which one.
we'll ask our listeners to get in touch with us on Blue Sky. We're on Blue Sky now. We've left Twitter.
Oh,
we're on
yes.
Blue Sky
yes.
now. So get in touch with us on Blue Sky. And it's very difficult to... We don't say tweet anymore. It was nice and easy to go, oh, just tweet
yeah,
us
it's
with
posts,
that.
Yeah, it's posts, isn't it? It's posts post, on Blue Sky.
So post at us on Blue Sky. And
they need and a ubiquitous word for that.
Yeah.
Yes, they
haven't
they
cracked
do.
It yet.
That was the really stupid thing. I'm going on a rant already. That was the really stupid thing about changing Twitter to X. It was the fact that Twitter and tweet had become so sort of embedded into our language. You know, tweet had become a verb. And like throwing that away for the sake of changing the logo and satisfying one's ego is a bit stupid, really.
It's just one
it's
of many
arrogance.
Brilliant decisions. Just
yes, and it was all downhill from there. But yes, we're on Blue Sky, so talk to us there. So we're here today to discuss, I suppose, a fairly iconic Big Finish trilogy. We're going to discuss the Villains trilogy that they did in the build-up to the 40th anniversary of Doctor Who. So we've got Omega, we've got Master, we've got Omega, we've got Davros, and we've got Master. Get it in order. And Joe, you wrote Master.
I did.
Yes.
Many years ago.
Yes. Well, 2021 at least.
Yeah.
And it was your second, am I right in thinking?
It was, yeah. I'd written The Rapture, which was a Sylvester McCoy and Sophie Aldred, and they went to Ibiza, where aliens are taking over the world with dance music and MDMA, I think it was. And... That didn't go down very well with Doctor Who fans, with lots of fans. Oh, I mean, also, it was my first script, so, you know, it does, you know, I freely admit it falls apart in the final episode and everything. But luckily for me, I was commissioned to write Master before The Rapture was released. So I got to come back because I think had The Rapture got the response it got and I hadn't been commissioned for Master, I suspect I wouldn't have been commissioned for it.
But thankfully you were, and the rest is history. And of course, The Rapture has brought about this episode of this podcast because I was in Ibiza recently and saw a sign up advertising Jude's Bar. And I thought, I know who I need to send this to.
Yes, yeah, it was
so
very fun.
So fired it over and we decided to podcast the game, which was nice. So there you go. The Rapture has, if nothing else, brought about this episode of this podcast.
I liked it. I've not heard it for a while.
I like it.
But I didn't have a problem.
Yeah. No, I think it's absolutely fantastic.
I haven't heard it in years. I remember being really proud of episode 2. I think episode 2 was something very different to what Big Finish had done before. I think episode 1 was good. I just think in episode 3, it as far as I can remember, it starts to fall apart plot-wise in episode 3. But I learned a lot from doing it. I learned a lot about plotting. Because I did the big thing I learned from it was... your ending has got to be as strong as your opening. whereas Rapture didn't. It had, I think, quite a strong opening and then sort of trailed off into nothing by the end. And I also learned to get off Doctor Who forums. I mean, I still read stuff, but yeah, not to really engage with ongoing fandom discussions, I suppose, on forums. Because I didn't think it was healthy for me, certainly, but also I don't think it's necessarily particularly healthy, or not healthy. It's not healthy for me, but I don't think it's particularly good for allowing free speech on a forum. People should be allowed to say they hate something that they've bought without thinking, oh, I don't want to upset someone's feelings. So I very quickly withdrew from Gallifrey, Outpost Gallifrey.
And it's the negative ones you remember as well, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah. And I got some real doozies. I did get not, you know, and I was like, in my early 20s, I was young, and I hadn't done anything before, and it was very exciting. And also, I wasn't part of fandom, you know, so I didn't really know what people liked or, you know, what the general consensus on things was. So I was really just really excited, and it came out, and yeah, it got some quite personal negative feedback, you know, which I did struggle with. So I very much was like, no, don't engage, which I think is the right thing to do. So, you know, even now I go, well, in many ways I was quite lucky because I very quickly withdrew from that sort of online world.
I'm sure it's become entirely lovely since then.
Yeah, it's great.
to be fair, I would say the audio part of Gallifrey and where base now is nicer than the TV section. Oh, I only look at audio and books now. I won't go near the TV anymore. They're too angry.
Yeah, no, I'm sure, you know. And also, I mean, you know, people are entitled to not like stuff, and people are entitled to say they don't like stuff. And I think especially if they've paid for it, they are, you know, very much entitled to say that. But there were things where it got personal, a lot of it based on my age and being a new writer. You know, so it did get very much, he must never write again. There were a couple of people in real life said, I remember once as a shopping centre, there was a shop called 10th Planet, and we used to sign autographs in it. And I was standing outside the shop with Rob Sherman. We were waiting for someone, presumably, who was signing autographs. And me and Rob were sort of taking the mick out of each other. And I think I was mocking his age, despite the fact that, you know, he was probably about 20 years younger than I am now. And he said, well, at least I didn't write The Rapture. You know, obviously joking. And this guy next to us turns around and goes, did one of you have something to do with The Rapture? Don't get me started on The Rapture. He said, well, we didn't. We didn't ask you to join our conversation. So, yeah, it was an interesting time. But then I got to write Master, and that went down a lot better.
Well, I think they're both brilliant, so there.
Oh, thank you.
And I did listen to The Rapture while I was in Ibiza.
Oh, excellent.
And I was in the bit of Ibiza in which it's set. So.
Oh, really? Oh, yes. Lovely. No, I've never been, so one day I would love to go. Yeah. And maybe I'll listen to The Rapture then for the first time in 20 years.
Yeah. I wonder how many people can claim that. I went to Ibiza to the correct place and listened to it while I was there.
Well, I think
it's probably not that many.
When it came out, the Venn diagram of Doctor Who fans and people who go to Ibiza was very, very, very yeah. small, which is one of the reasons it didn't go down very well. I suspect these days it's much wider because it's a much broader, wider audience due to the new series and younger, literally younger people enjoying it. So I suspect there's a bit more of a... But I don't suppose many have taken it out there to do that. That's certainly a choice.
Yeah. People at the airport customs are like, really?
Yeah, what? Why?
Oh, no, I had it ready to go. Just like, there's one thing I need to do while I'm there. Just one thing. Listen to the Rapture, obviously. It was great. It was good. And it was sunny. It was October and it was 26 degrees. So no complaints whatsoever. But we're not here to talk about the Rapture as much as we do love it. So just before we do dive into that villains trilogy, like I said, Joe, we've had you on before. It was near enough a couple of years ago now. We're coming up to 2 years, I think. In fact, you came up with the date before, didn't you? It was January
23.
So yeah, near enough a couple of years. And you've done things since then.
Well, I've left the house on a couple of years before.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah.
Hey, if we'd have recorded this in 2020, you wouldn't have necessarily.
No, exactly. But what have you been up to? Just crying. Doing a lot of crying. I've done a couple of things, a big finish. Other than that, I've been doing two episodes of a kids' TV show, new series, which is filming right now. So that's very exciting. It's been a process. There's a finance coming in from all different countries, which means there's lots of notes coming in from all different countries. I did get one of the favourite notes I've ever had, which was, can you tone down the amount of references to food in your episode? Because I hadn't realised I write food a lot into things because I really like food. So I tend to have people talk about food a lot in my scripts, and I started thinking about it and going back to my Sarah Janes and Tortured and going, yep, there's food, yep, they mention food, yep, someone's cooking. So I've done that, and I've been doing some theatre, which is very nice. I'm actually starting some paid theatre, which is very good. I've never done before. That's very exciting. I've become a pescatarian, so I will rant about the evils of meat. Well, I don't, but there's been lots of changes. But yes, I've done two things, a big finish, I think, that have come out. And I've got one coming out this month, actually, next month, well, 2 days' time. I wrote the first story of the sort of sequel to the Sarah Jane Adventures, which was about Rani Bannerman Road. And I wrote a Torchwood 1 story featuring Yanto and Tommy. And I've got a Christmas Torchwood coming out this year, which is Ace and Mr. Colchester, which was a thrill.
Which I'm very much looking forward to. Mm. And will in all likelihood be out by the time this makes it online, but
it's got a piece of writing in I'm really proud of. There's four short stories, and the second one in particular, I'm very sort of, yeah, that's, I've done something I've wanted to do since the beginning of the year. I saw a film called All of Us Strangers came out earlier on this year, and I fell in love with it. I think it's a stunning piece of filmmaking, and I wanted to do something that really delves into sort of the gay life of somebody, say, in London in the 80s. See how it goes down. Hopefully it'll go down well.
Looking forward to it. And like I say, we may actually have covered it in a podcast before this goes out.
Oh, right.
We never know. We're in between series at the moment, so we're kind of recording a few things ready. We'll be back up and running soon, next month, but we're banking a few episodes, and we thought this would be a good one to just have ready to throw out.
Good plan.
You know, if the first few episodes don't do too well, we can sort of put, look, we've got Joe Lidster again.
Great.
Just to try and bring our listeners back. That's the plan, obviously.
Yeah.
Anyway, the main theme, let's get to our feature presentation. We're going to be talking about, as I say, the Villains trilogy, as it's sort of colloquially known, that Big Finish brought out for the 40th anniversary. And it was kind of in the build-up to Zagreus as well, which was culminating 2 years of Eighth Doctor Adventures. But we're going to do Zagreus another time. So right now it's Omega, Davros and Master, which I think are generally universally beloved, I think it's fair to say. I've never sort of caught anybody online going, oh, no, I can't stand Davros, it's terrible, and nothing like that. So I'm going to enter this assuming that everybody loves these three stories, and they should do. They're absolutely brilliant. It was quite different for Big Finish, because obviously they weren't doing trilogies at the time and wouldn't really adopt the trilogy format for quite a few years after this. It was probably six, seven years before we fully got into trilogy territory.
Had they done Excellus by this point?
Well, I was about to ask you that and would hope that you knew the answer to
it. I can tell you that they had, because when we recorded The Rapture, we recorded extra voices for the Plague Herds of Excellus. So you can hear me in the background of Plague Herds of Excellus. So that would have been 2002, isn't it? But I think Excellus came out as a bonus one each month, didn't it? I don't think it... Like Dalek Empire, it was an extra thing.
Yeah.
Wasn't Excellus to give us some of the other three Doctors while they did nothing but 6 months of Paul McGann for the Invaders?
That's a funny situation, isn't it? To imagine that we might be sick of that.
Yeah.
After years of no Paul McGann, they're like, oh, people are really whining about, where's Colin? So we need to...
Yeah. Like, did anybody listen to Chimes of Midnight and go, oh, but where's Colin Baker?
He's around.
He's around.
I think,
he's
actually, to be
around.
Fair, probably at that time, there were, in the way that people are, you know, people, some Doctor Who fans, especially, you know, you'll find the older Doctor Who fans, you will get people who, you know, I mean, loathe the TV movie. So we're very much Paul McGann does not count. And that seems so quaint now compared to how much of the new series has been. But there was, I'm sure there was definitely at the time people going, I won't buy these because the TV movie and the half human and the American stuff doesn't count. So they probably, there would be, I imagine there would have been people who wouldn't, but I imagine there'd be more people that would buy them.
Yeah, I mean, I found those first couple of Paul McGann runs to be really interesting. They were sort of very forward-looking. We hadn't had the new series yet, so it was very much, this is what 21st century Doctor Who is.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had other attempts. We had Scream of the Shalka and, you know, the little bits and bobs like that. But ultimately, that was Doctor Who for a long time. And I'm a bit too young to have been properly on board at that point, but part of me wishes I was. Part of me does kind of wish that those first couple of McGann series were Doctor Who.
It was incredibly exciting. I mean, it was very, because it just felt, and the covers looked different. Everything about it felt new and fresh, and it had an arc, you know, which obviously the old series never really had, but modern television was starting to have more arcs and things. I think Lost was a big thing around then. So, you know, it was very much representing what was being made at the time, I think. Which then, obviously, the new series immediately had arcs and stuff because
that's what
people expect. Yeah.
So it's... And this trilogy sort of loosely ties into that arc, because as I said before, it's kind of that build up to Zagreus, and I assume that part of the brief for that trilogy, or for Master certainly, was to have a Zagreus reference.
No, I don't think so.
Oh, really?
I don't remember that being a thing. I think I thought I'd do it. I had no idea what Zagreus was. I just knew it had been mentioned in Project Twilight and then in the Eighth Doctor stuff. So I knew, and then obviously I knew there was a story coming out called Zagreus, but I genuinely had no idea what it was. And if I'm honest right now, I don't know what Zagreus is. I think he's a Time Lord or something. But I just thought, in a story that's going to be creepy and I want pure horror, audio, psychological, creepy stuff, there's a nursery rhyme there that's been mentioned. And I think it was put in the trailer, and I think it was just that thing of going, actually, that's really exciting because it's the next month's story. So, yeah, no, but I think it was my choice. I don't think I was asked to do it.
That's interesting, because maybe I'm wrong, but I re-listened to them sort of recently preparing for this, and I could have sworn there's a Zagreus reference in each of the three.
There's definitely one in Omega. I'm not sure about the other two.
I can
imagine Gary might have said to Nev, because Ark Infinity is about Time Lords, isn't it? So it would make sense to mention Zagreus, whereas it maybe wouldn't in Davros. And obviously in mine, it was a nightmarish voice, I think.
Yeah, it's... Well, that's interesting. I always assumed it was...
You have to speak to Gary Russell. He remembers everything. Yeah. I don't remember yesterday, so I certainly don't remember 20 years
ago.
Fair
enough.
But I've got a feeling... I thought it was me, but I can guarantee Gary might say it was him, and he'd be right.
Like I say, I was listening and just thought, maybe there's something going on here. They were building up to this. There we go. So the first one in our trilogy is Omega, which explores Omega, brings back Ian Collier as Omega, and sort of works as a sort of sequel to Ark of Infinity, but very much does its own thing as well, I think. It's a Nev Fountain script, so it's witty, it's full of moments, great moments, and has a very, very memorable, twisty cliffhanger. Which, when I very first heard this story, had to listen to about four times to go, what, really? Really? But it pulls it off. It's a great little story. It's a great start for this trilogy as well. Naturally, just because of the way I prefer my Doctor Who, I would be least excited about the Fifth Doctor story in a trilogy like this. But no, this is up there with the other two, and it's very much enjoyable. So, Gareth, do you want to talk to us about Omega? Get us going.
Sure. So I've always kind of struggled with Arc of Infinity. I always feel it's a very, very technobabble heavy, and kind of Three Doctors as well. I'm clearly team not Omega, I'm afraid, just from the classic series point of view, because you've got great performances, but the moment people start explaining antimatter to me, bits of my brain die. So I just can't get on board with that. There is a spectacularly complicated Star Trek original series episode about antimatter, and it always just makes me just think, nah, pass. But with Omega, with this particular release, it's Nev Fountain, and he's tremendously funny, and it's an incredibly grim comedy. It's got kind of whiffs of Douglas Adams in it. There's a bit in it, I've written this down. Somebody refers to an electronic sulking machine, which is just pure Marvin, really. And it's very clever the way it kind of calls forward to things that are going to happen. There's another line I've jotted down: fooled by a convincing copy, how embarrassing, which is amazing the second time you hear it. And it's interesting that you were saying about Peter Davison, well, not Peter Davison necessarily, the Fifth Doctor, being maybe not the one you would at a certain age want to be the lead of something in Doctor Who. I felt that way. In audio, I like him a lot better. This is a great showcase for him, because he gets to play, I don't know how much we can spoil it, right? I mean, it's pretty old, but he gets to play different characters.
I think our listeners have heard it.
They might have heard it. So he gets to play different characters, basically. I think an interesting thing, which goes for all three, and I'm interested to hear about the kind of genesis of Master for this particular aspect, is that they all kind of try to interrogate who this baddie is. You know, baddie in inverted commas. Are they horrible? Are they something else? And Omega, I think, I go back and forth over whether this or Master is kind of ultimately the most sympathetic to the character. Omega, I feel, is very much, this is a tragic person. What a pitiful figure. This guy needs a hug. You know, this bloke has been broken by history, and ultimately by the Doctor, because, you know, their merging in Arc of Infinity has caused him to have, he was already in a very bad place, but he's worse now because of that specifically, which is so sad. And now he has to just relive history over and over again. And I think that whole thing is just such an interesting choice to go, we're nearing an anniversary, we want to do a story about a character, let's bring back let's bring back the Nymon and say, what if the Nymon's, you know, got a lot on his plate right now? You know, you wouldn't expect to go there. And with Omega, of all characters, because you just think of Stephen Thorne and his mighty booming voice, the idea that that character is just going to be this pure unfortunate person, I just think is a really interesting take. And the whole thing is framed as just this kind of wicked comedy, just like evil things that you find funny in it, you know, characters like having their hands lopped off and stuff. It's just a very, very unusual piece of Doctor Who, and a very weird piece for Peter Davison, but in a great kind of challenging way. And yeah, the part three cliffhanger, just, oh god, like I don't think I was spoiled the first time I heard that. I feel very pleased about that, just to get to that point and go, I don't know what I was doing the last three episodes, I was completely wrong. And it's so rare that you can, you know, the rug pull like that. But yeah, I think Omega, it's not the most kind of obviously sort of fan pleasing one of the three. I mean, we'll get into like why those other two might have more of that to offer, but it's kind of the oddest one in some ways. And I think revisiting it is always a very pleasant experience, and going, god, that was really interesting. So for the 40th, I think, Big Finish did well, you know, for us. I think we were quite lucky.
Certainly started strong. It's that Douglas Adams comparison's very interesting, because I've made it before as well. I've sort of said, if we've got Douglas Adams at Big Finish, it is Nev Fountain. He's a fantastic comedy writer, and I'm a big Dead Ringers fan, so sort of listen to other things he does as well.
I'm gonna plug his books as well. If you ever read, he did those Mervyn Stone books, Geek Tragedy.
Oh, yes.
They're all very good, but Geek Tragedy is just like the perfect. I've not been to many Doctor Who conventions, but that is it. That is exactly the experience. So it's really good.
Oh, I'm gonna have to look that up then. Is there anything you'd like to add about Omega, Joe?
I haven't listened to them in 20 years, but I remember when it came out, I didn't know Nev at the time at all. We're good friends now, but I can't remember when I did first meet him. But I remember listening to Omega when it came out and being slightly like, oh, that's so good. Oh, no. What's going on? But I think one of the things I did love about the Village trilogy generally was, I think, other than the Excellus thing, it was the first time they were doing full stories without companions. And I think that allowed you to do a different type of story. So it allowed Nev to do a story that can do the episode 3 cliffhanger, which it wouldn't have been able to do if Nessa had been there. And I think that's just the genius of Nev. I think what a genius idea to do. He's really clearly sat down and gone, what can I do that does this? And just come up with this astonishing, I think one of the biggest and best beats that's ever happened in a Big Finish story to this day. I think it's so clever. And I just remember finding the story really, really funny. Because I hate Time Lords. I hate, they should always be gone. And to do a story that's a comedy involving the Time Lords, I think is such a clever idea. I think it's an astonishing piece of work. I think it's very clever, very funny, and very sad at places as well. The other thing Nev does is there's always actually real emotion in it as well. It's never just sitcom-y. There's always a bit of depth to it as well. He's done a companion chronicle called Perry and the Piscom Paradox, I think it's called. And that's an astonishing piece of work. Again, very clever, very funny, but real emotion and emotional maturity to it, which he brings to his writing. And yes, I very much recommend. Is it Mervyn
Stone?
I've got them behind me somewhere. And he's just got a new book out that's come out this year. Which I can't remember the name of, but I know I'm getting it for Christmas. I can quickly look because it's on my wish list. But The Fan Who Knew Too Much, which I think is the start of a new series he's doing, which I can guarantee, if it's anything as good as Mervyn Stone, is going to be a brilliant, glorious read.
I think I'm just sold on the name of that one. I think on the name alone.
Yeah, it's such a great name.
It's worth going for. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, I think he's very good, a bit like he does with the Time Lords in Omega. Nev writes about fan culture, rightfully mocking it for many things, even though he is, as big a nerd as anybody, but also gets the actual heart of why people are fans and why we love Doctor Who and why we're sitting here talking about it, and things like that. I think he's very good at being able to laugh at himself and at fans while at the same time laughing with them but never laughing at them, I think is what he does. It's very clever. And he does that, I think, with Omega. I think all the stuff about time travel and the Time Lords and stuff in that, if I remember rightly, is very much, aren't the Time Lords a bit boring? But isn't it fun that they exist and we love them? We love the nonsense of, the people around that table in the Five Doctors. There's so much joy to be had about them. I think, he's a really, really brilliant writer.
I like to think that he looked at that, those around the table in the Five Doctors and went, what if they went on holiday?
Exactly. it's
fantastic.
It's brilliant. Because again, it's so Doctor Who, Doctor Who trying to do this mysterious race of godlike beings. And it's three actors sat around a lit-up table and all sat on one side because it's studio setup, and saying the most Bobbins lines you've ever heard, And that's the joy of Doctor Who, is that when it tries to do, it's better when it's not doing it. So when it does do it, it's great fun. And we love it.
Absolutely. So that's one strong story down in our villains trilogy. Let's move on straight to story number two then, which is the Colin Baker entry into the trilogy. It is Davros. I really, really love the basic idea of this story, which is, well, what happens when Davros is there but the Daleks aren't, which is ultimately the sort of catch of this story. And it's great. It leads into sort of a lot of the stuff that, as far as I can gather, it's set before Revelation of the Daleks, and Revelation of the Daleks kind of serves as a sequel to this. I'm happy to be corrected if either of you have caught a reference that I've not or anything like that, but I really like the idea of sort of Davros goes corporate. It's such a great concept, and you know, I think this is the first one Terry Molloy did for Big Finish as Davros, so it's amazing how he just picks that character up, and it's exactly the character that we had in Revelation of the Daleks, and to a lesser extent, I guess, Remembrance of the Daleks. 15 years after all of that, and straight away he is Davros, completely and totally Davros, totally recognisable, amazing as the character, but doing something totally different. This is really uncharted territory for Davros, and when he's not got an army of Daleks to order around, or he's not got to scheme against his own creations, he's kind of left to scheme and manipulate other people. And the results are just brilliant, and I'm really glad that this story exists. As far as I'm aware, we've not had another Dalekless Davros story.
I feel like it's something I've seen, but I can't recall what else.
It feels like something they'd have done again, because this is so good, but I can't think of anything off the top of my head right now. And part of me sort of wants them to do another one, and part of me doesn't, because it's never going to be as good as Davros is. So I'm kind of torn on that one. So Gareth, talk to us about Davros.
I think this might be either the first Big Finish story I ever heard, or one of the first few. A friend sent me copies of a couple. I bought them all since, just to be clear. It was The Holy Terror, Spare Parts, and Davros. So he set the bar unfairly high, I would say. Yeah. But no. It's all been great since. But Davros is another knockout, really. It's interesting, Joe, you mentioned that this is the Doctorless thing, and that's something I think we've seen so much of since, especially on TV series, because Christmases, they'll go, it's a between period, we can have that, that you kind of forget how weird it was back at the time. But it works really well for these three stories, because it gives the Doctor the excuse to just crystallize and like zero in on like why I don't like that guy, or what I think the problem is going to be here. So it's an interesting kind of production choice that you don't necessarily really notice as being important as a listener. It really frees the story up so the Doctor can just be the greatest pain he can possibly be. And in this, he is an absolute sod, just horrible to Davros all the way through. It's fantastic. Johnson, like you were saying, with Davros gets a job is the byline of this, and I think that's hilarious. It does kind of really it feels like the same sort of space as Revelation of the Daleks, that it's very season 22. The kind of corporate nastiness was very big back then, there's this idea that Davros might be going straight. Maybe towards the end of the story he says he was trying to go straight. I don't think that's necessarily true, but he might even believe that. But it's a really great story for kind of showing the sort of lengths of his character and the kind of, the extremes. Because I think it all goes back to good old Michael Wisher and the bit with, yes, I would press that button and I would do it. And, screw everyone. I would do it just so that I could say I've done it. And this story has a few examples of like exactly that. And, there's a bit where he comes up with this formula that will allow him to just completely wreck the stock market if he feels like it, or more importantly, rig it so he could be incredibly rich. And people around him are like, oh, wow, you've come up with this incredible thing that will allow you to be incredibly rich, and he's just like, yeah, I guess it's better that I just use it because I can just create chaos. It's as long as we're clear, I want to use it. That's him. He just wants to do the thing because he's discovered how to do it. And there's a wonderful flashback in it where he describes his sort of incineration back when that happened and he became the disfigured creature he is. And he says that he looked at his hand and he could see his skeleton, and he started just wiggling his fingers so he could watch them move. And like the idea of being that far gone as like a scientific absolutionist that you're like, oh, I'm in tremendous pain, but this is cool. And he just doesn't care. So that's all fascinating. And we get kind of, and I've really no idea how the kind of, how the relationship between this story and the iDavros series works. I don't know if that was already kind of on the go, because that came a few years later. But we see these little chunks of his life that would sort of get revisited in that series. And again, we kind of see kind of hints of his true character. And he's kind of like, he likes to explore ideas to their horrible conclusion. But we also see hints of him as an emotional being. And he has, is it Shan or Shan, this person in his life, who ultimately he betrays and has killed. I want to say because he finds out she's sleeping with somebody who isn't him. That's not the reason he thinks it is. He thinks it's, you know, he's got this whole psychosis where he's like, oh no, this guy must be a traitor, and therefore you're a traitor. He's worked it all out. But this horrible truth that he doesn't want to face is that, well, actually, he quite liked this person and she doesn't feel that way about him. So, and he's just desperate not to face that. And the idea that Davros could have this incredibly human motivation just buried under all of this stuff, and you know, to survive that, he's absolutely determined to believe that no, I don't have anything, I don't have any emotions at all, I am a monster, thank you doctor for trying, but no, I'm gonna stick with evil. And it's just, you just don't buy it by the end of the story. You think this is a man with problems, and he's allowed himself to be overcome by these monstrous impulses that he does have. And yeah, at one point he kind of refers to the doctor as being the closest thing he's ever had to a friend, which is fascinating. Obviously, you know, Colin's doctor not really going to help that impulse along, unfortunately, because he's not very nice to him. It's a tremendously kind of well cast audio. I haven't checked this. Is it Bernard Horsfall? Is that,
yes,
the voice,
yes,
or am I getting,
I
that wrong?
So, yeah.
Every time I listen to it, I think, was he still around? Did they really have Bernard Horsfall? Because I love Bernard. He's amazing in anything he's in. But he's great in this because you get to see some of that kind of evil corporate characters who are, you know, maybe as bad as he is. They kind of, as the story goes on, him and Wendy Padbury, who apparently can do evil very convincingly, they get to kind of mellow a bit as they kind of go, okay, wow, I knew he'd be bad, but I didn't think he'd be that bad. But there's a great early scene where Bernard's character has just been systematically killing people on this spaceship until one of them can open the door. It's like, well, I hope you get it right, because I'm running out of guys here. So that's it's a great dynamic, and they kind of have this awkward relationship with the doctor where he's you know, he's trying to just go, well, I can just do all of the amazing stuff that you need done. You don't need Davros. And they want both of them, of course. And it's funny too. I mean, I would say in a kind of distinct way from Omega, it's got a kind of season 22, terrible people just being dreadful kind of comedy workplace awkwardness. The doctor, you know, jamming screwdrivers in his ear to get out an annoying little voice in his head. Yeah, I would say it's probably of the three the least sympathetic to the villain character, but I think in suggesting that he has these depths that even he is just not remotely ready to kind of look at or interrogate, in a way, I think it's just as sympathetic, because it's just kind of going, well, he's never going to get any better, but, you know, he's not as evil as the doctor thinks he is, or as he thinks he is, and that is sadly a comfort to him, to think he's basically a Dalek. But yeah, so it's pretty strong, I think. Pretty good.
So yeah, it's some really interesting points there. Like, first of all, yes, it's a fantastically cast story, and as you say, Bernard Horsfall just could never do any wrong. And I kind of love him and Wendy Padbury as this sort of oligarchical double act. They're absolutely fantastic. They make such a great pair. And it really is a good character study into Davros. And, you know, we do get to see a side of him that we really, really don't anywhere else. You couldn't do this story with Daleks. The whole point of it is Daleks aren't there. But it doesn't make a big thing about the Daleks not being there. It's very much a case of Davros is just doing what he's doing, and the fact that the Daleks aren't there don't affect him. And I'm, you know, it would have got in the way if we'd have had nothing but, oh, but I need my Daleks. Where are my Daleks? I'm going to build some more Daleks. I'm going to turn you into a Dalek, which is what we get with anything else with Davros in. You know, we have done experimental stuff with Davros. I mean, Joe, you've done it yourself in Terra Firma, sort of with his identity crisis in that and that kind of thing. You know, we've had, is it the Curse of Davros?
The one where... Yeah, another Colin one.
The one where him and Colin do swapsies, and the episode 2 cliffhanger is the Doctor was Davros all along and that kind of thing.
Freaky Friday with Davros. It's really good.
Freaky Friday with Davros. I've never heard it referred to as that before, but that's fantastic, yes. So, yeah, it's a great story. And I do think that Omega could never have fit into season 20. It is not a season 20 story at all. But Davros could have fit into season 22. It could have fit, you know, nicely in there just after the two Doctors or whatever. It's a very of its era story. It does have that theme of corporate greed, which does sort of run through quite a few stories in season 22. So it's quite interesting that it's this one flies a little bit closer to home than Omega does. And I mean, Master's totally unlike anything in the McCoy era, but we'll get to that in a minute. Joe, is there anything you'd like to add about Davros at all?
I remember it had the best trailer Big Finish had ever had, because I think Lance had written a speech for Davros. No, he hadn't. No, because it's Jim Mortimer does the sound design. So I think it might be a Jim Mortimer thing, because he did the music and the sound for The Rapture. Yeah. But I remember it's the Davros trailer was so... effing brilliant. It was just so exciting. And also Davros being back was exciting. And yeah, I can remember it was just being it being such a clever script that's really about stuff. It's, you know, all the stuff about corporate greed and all that sort of thing. It's actually genuinely exploring this stuff and doing it brilliantly. And then all I remember is I did listen to it a few times because, yeah, Terra Firma I wrote as a sequel to basically Davros and Remembrance of the Daleks. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff in Terra Firma of the Doctor and Davros talking that slightly acknowledges the thing in Davros where he says, you're the closest thing I've got to a friend. Because obviously Davros has had this long, ridiculously long life where everybody he's ever known is dead except for the Doctor. So for me, that was what, you know, that established in Davros really did help mould Terra Firma. No, I remember it just being brilliant, really, really clever. Just really clever.
Yeah, I've definitely picked up on that sort of Terra Firma following on from Davros thing before. They're probably the two stories that explore the character the most. I think, is it the Juggernauts, the other Colin Baker and Davros story.
In which that Davros gets a job.
Yes.
It's a very popular genre by that point.
I do kind of get Terra Firma and... No, not Terra Firma. I do kind of get Davros and the Juggernauts mixed up occasionally, because they do kind of do corporate Davros. Both of them do. But it's... it's obviously a great idea. It obviously works, and it's worked very well in two very different ways. And it's great that obviously you did pick up on Davros and you did work with that to get where you did with Terra Firma, which is, like I say, another great exploration of the character. We're joined by somebody else. We're joined by Mansour. Hello, Mansour.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for jumping on. I'm glad you could join us, even if it is a tad late. So it's the Seventh Doctor's entry in this trilogy. I mean, first of all, I love the fact that this trilogy does cover the three classic Doctors that Big Finish had at this time. And obviously, McGann was doing McGann things. We've had a couple of series of him, and we've got Zagreus coming up after Master. But it's really kind of great that this is what they did for kind of those Doctors in the 40th instead of the Simons of Time 2 or whatever. You know, the temptation must have been there to kind of go, well, let's just do that again. But they've not. Instead, they've used it as an opportunity to sort of explore what makes the Doctor tick by exploring what makes his most iconic adversaries and Omega tick. It is a wonderful trilogy. So we're on to Master, and we've sort of said that, you know, Omega goes very much against your standard Davison. It's not a season 20 story. Davros kind of plays to Colin Baker's strengths and could fit into season 22. Master, is it fair to say it's a new adventure story? Is that kind of where you were aiming for with it, Joe? Or
Yeah, I suppose so. I was, given the fact that he would be, I think the main thing I slightly rebelled against was I was told it had to be on an alien planet, not on Earth. And I didn't, I'm not necessarily a huge sci-fi fan. I like things like Doctor Who and Star Trek because they tend to tell horror stories, and then there's a kitchen sink drama, then it's a comedy, then it's this. I tend to like, no, I don't really, I wouldn't, you know, not really got a massive interest in developing an exciting new alien culture planet thing. So I had that, and also I was given the thing that he'd lost his memory. And the big thing for me was trying to work out the difference between Omega and Davros and the Master is that Omega and Davros have backstories. Even if Davros isn't much established pre Genesis of the Daleks, you do know that at some point he's been in an accident. You do know about the war on Skaro, that he's, you know, Omega, we know pretty much his whole backstory, or, you know, certainly a big chunk of it, of what defines him as a character. With the Master, there hadn't been that any kind of exploration. And also, I kind of feel, because he was created as the Doctor's Moriarty, he doesn't really have a massive backstory. So sometimes he wants to control the universe, sometimes he wants to destroy things, sometimes he wants to, it's all personal with the Doctor, sometimes the Doctor just happens to bump into him. You know, so I felt he's less of a character than Omega and Davros, which meant I really had to go, well, what am I going to do? Because it's clearly meant to be a character exploring story. So I thought back, and I actually went back to his first story, the Autons, and there's a scene in that which must have been amazing to see at the time, and still I think holds up really well, which is the scientist in the, what is it, a tower?
The telescope thing.
And there's a scientist and he kills him and puts him in his lunchbox, and I watched that and went, the Master doesn't need to do that. There's no reason for him to actually kill that scientist. He could knock him out. He could do anything. And we know, actually, that the scientist has a wife and he's going to have a boiled egg and things like that. So, actually, he gives him a little character, and then the Master kills him for no reason. And I thought, well, actually, that's what the Master does. The Master kills people. So I basically looked at serial killers, especially Jeffrey Dahmer, and basically read a lot about Jeffrey Dahmer, what made him become Jeffrey Dahmer, and about that sort of first death that is wrong, but if he got caught after the first death, he would not only would he have literally not been able to commit all the other murders, but he mentally might not have done, because the first death, I think, that Jeffrey Dahmer does is more of an accident, and I suspect that's probably the case with a lot of killers, you know, serial killers, is, wait a minute, this feels good, and wait a minute, I'm okay doing this, this is who I am. So it's kind of a justifying it to yourself kind of thing. So with the Master, when I decided I was going to do that, I kind of thought back to the New Adventures and thought about how they made the Doctor Time's champion. So would the Master be Death's champion if he's causing all this death? If that's the one thing the Master achieves in every story is death, that makes him Death's champion. And I then realised, I suppose, yeah, and as somebody who'd enjoyed the New Adventures, that it was quite New Adventure-y. So I decided to set it on a planet with the adjudicators from the books and things like that. So I could do a sort of, basically, it's Victorian Edwardian Earth, but it isn't really. It's an alien planet, which is my sort of workaround of set it on an alien planet. So, yeah, I think I knew it was quite New Adventure-y, but I think also it's so funny to think back. Like, we're talking about this trilogy, and you kind of, you know, there'd only been one Master story since Survival. There'd been Dustbreeding. Oh, I think it did a couple of New Adventures, but there'd been Dustbreeding and then Master. Davros hadn't been in it before, whereas now, like you say, there's the Juggernauts, there's the Curse of Davros, there's all these other Davros stories. So I think at that point, I felt that the New Adventures leading into the TV movie, which I'd really enjoyed because I was really enjoying the New Adventures, was very excited about the TV movie. So loved that sense that they did of leading up to and stopping just before. So for me, Master was very much set after he's left Chris, I don't know how to say his surname, and he's travelling alone before Lungbarrow and stuff. So for me, Master was always is set in that world. So yeah, I suppose you would call it, you know, some New Adventures. But also, I think, to be totally honest, I never really felt a big need to make them feel like they're of their period. I love it when they do. I think it's so much fun when you hear a Sylvester that's very clearly season 24. But I, as a writer, never really did that with The Rapture or The Master or anything I think that I did afterwards. I don't think I ever really set out to go, how can I make it feel like it's part of season whatever it is. So it's a very long, winding answer. Sorry, yeah. It's basically, yes, I probably went down more of the Omega way of, yeah, it's not, you know, I'm not going, this is season, you know, he's just dropped Ace off.
I think that probably works to its advantage, though. It's the fact that, I mean, the Seventh Doctor has a lot of eras, doesn't he? There's a, you know, everyone likes to point at the Seventh Doctor and go, oh, yeah, that was season 24. That was shortly after Survival. Oh, that was towards the end of his life. And I like the fact that with the Seventh Doctor, we can probably work out it is towards the end of his life, but he's got this sort of muddy period where all sorts of stuff happens and he's sort of a terrible person to varying levels and all that kind of thing. And I like the fact that it's still sort of shrouded in mystery after, even now, you know, even though Big Finish have tried to pick it out and they've tried to sort of go, well, this happens here and this happens there. It's certainly like a nice sort of vague idea, but I think that is something the New Adventures did. I'm not overly familiar with them. I've read a few, but not many. But they do have this sort of very unique feel. And I think Master certainly leans more towards those than season 24 at any rate.
Yes. Well, I think there was a thing in the New Adventures, if I remember rightly, again, I've not read them in years, but there was a sense of the Seventh Doctor novels wrapping up things.
Yeah.
That the Seventh Doctor was fixing things because he knew his time was coming to an end. And I think that was my thing with Master, was he knew his time was coming to an end. So he made a deal with Death to give the Master 10 years, I think, of a nice life.
Yeah, so that's really interesting because I didn't know that about kind of mentally placing it in the New Adventures. I did read them all quite recently. I had never read them. I completely missed that whole period, and then I picked them up because of Big Finish, because they did Love and War, and I thought, oh, okay, what else happens? And read them all. Yeah, definitely towards the end, the Seventh Doctor is very much trying to get his house in order, and also I think trying to kind of atone, really. I think after once he reached that point where Ace leaves for good this time, I think he's kind of the book range, as well as the character, has kind of grown up a bit and kind of learned to, you don't need to be angsty all the time. Yes. But in that context, this is interesting, because that means he's kind of like, this one's going to be rough. And he's like, okay, I'll step off the I'm not that bad actually train and divert over here to something that we learn is one of the sort of darker, nastier things about him that he didn't necessarily know. Which is, by the way, I mean, this is kind of jumping ahead, really, but that's quite a controversial choice, I would say, the Doctor.
I suppose,
did that.
It didn't. I didn't think it was that controversial, because I didn't think there'd be that many more stories. So I think, you know, I don't think we knew the TV series was coming back, did we, at that point? So I think we didn't know there was going to be a new TV series. At that point, Big Finish was 12 stories a year. So I felt the likelihood of it ever, you know, with Sylvester and Jeffrey Beavers ever do another audio together? I didn't, you know, whereas now obviously they've done loads, because Big Finish does a lot more stories. So it starts to actually have more of an impact. Whereas I think actually if it had been this one-off thing, you'd have gone, oh, you know, I don't like that, but, you know, it's happened. Whereas, yeah, I think I wasn't bothered about doing it. And the thing for me was, it was what's most interesting for the character, what's most interesting for both characters, the main characters. And that was the most interesting thing I could think of. I thought it was, and basically what I was doing was, it's absolutely a reference to an unearthly child. It's literally, the Doctor is going to smash someone's head in with a rock in an unearthly child. And it turns out, according to what his vague memories or dreams or what the Master says are, is that it's what he did as a child. So it wouldn't be his, so the caveman wouldn't have been his first one.
If only he'd had an Ian.
Yeah, exactly. And my whole point was, they're children in it. They are very specifically children. They are neither of them have set out to do anything, you know, and they've been taken advantage of by death. But it's all a story, you know. It's like, I haven't, again, not heard it in years, but if I remember rightly, it's all we don't see it happen. It's not like the Davros flashbacks. We don't actually get a very clear scene of it happening. We get a child saying stuff and things like that, but it's all told as a story. So, yeah, I mean, it's probably been contradicted by a million things by now, but, you know, that's such what it is. For me, again, I'm less, it's a bit like not making it fit into a certain style or season. I'm less interested in, I don't care if someone contradicts Master or people think it doesn't happen. For me, for that story, it had to be that very simple switch of the characters to explain the Doctor and the Master's actions in the story. If it hadn't been that, then it wouldn't have been a very good story. Or it would have been a weaker story, I think. And I think when you're doing an audio drama, whether it's part of a series or not, you go for what is that best story, not what fits in with something else or does that, while still, I think, staying consistent to the characters. You know, again, I probably wouldn't have done that if it hadn't been Sylvester's Seventh Doctor, which had gone very dark in the New Adventures and was hinted at going dark in the TV series. You know, I wouldn't have done that if I was writing if it had been a Peter Davison story. I don't think I would have felt that fitted in with the existing characterization.
It's interesting that it is Sylvester, because he's one manipulation ahead of himself, because this is famously the Doctor, you know, chess player and all of that, and in this one we find out, you know, there was a time when he did something that even he has deleted. That's a great idea. When I was listening to these three again, with this story, there is kind of the, forgive me, there is the little fan voice at the head that's like, oh, I don't like this, the Doctor's a bad guy. It's the childish fan voice. But I thought what was really interesting was, once it got into it, the Doctor already feels bad, because in his version of events, he didn't kill anybody, but he effectively, you know, there was a cover-up. He worked towards that. Yeah. He knows it was wrong. So either way, he's leaving Gallifrey a guilty man, and that's part of that. So then to later on find out, well, actually, it was the other thing, kind of doesn't really change that. It's still the same. And I thought it was very interesting. Similar in a way, I don't know, well, similar to Omega, in that there's kind of this cross-pollination between the two characters, the Doctor and the villain. And in this one, very, very explicitly, it's kind of a there but by the grace of God thing, where it's just, you know, the Doctor and the Master, they're different people, but they could have had very different lives if not for this thing. And, you know, that you've written in the thing where the Doctor kind of goes, how can anyone forgive me for this? This is appalling. And the Master's like, we were kids. It's not great, but, you know, and this figure that exists took advantage of us. So yeah, I think it's a great kind of study of that, and kind of the whole thing is just very, very themed about the motives of evil and how all these people are kind of, and that's interesting that you're saying about that like Dharma was going through your head when you were writing it, you know, well, there we go. There's a person where motives don't really enter into it. And you've got these characters all kind of talking about murders and stuff, going like, why do people do these things? And the idea that there is this death force that just kind of manipulates you. But even under that, there are moments where, just interestingly, the Master kind of isn't in this, really. Not very much.
No.
You know, we've got the person, but the voice only comes out a few times. And there are moments where he's like, oh, no, shut up, I did it all. And he kind of doesn't agree with death. And that's another thing that it kind of shares with Davros, really, that you've got this character who's got these motivations, and they're like, yeah, well, that's one version. And I think that's great. You've got all these characters sort of separate from that.
Yeah, so, no, I was just going to say, actually, I do think it was probably, again, a conscious decision of mine to have him as a different character, because I thought the Master isn't someone you believe would sit down and discuss things with, well, maybe he would, but I don't know. I grew up with Anthony Ainley's Master, who I adore, but he is batshit crazy. You know, he is not someone who's going to sit down and go, oh, Doctor, let's talk about the themes of evil, or let's talk about our childhoods, you know. So I suppose I grew up with that. For me, in case of Master, it wasn't like, whereas I would believe the Doctor and Davros, because we've seen them do it, the Doctor and Davros have had proper conversations in the TV series. You know, Omega is a very, not relatable necessarily, character, but he is a character with a very understandable backstory that I can understand. Even in the Three Doctors, you can understand the tragedy of his character, whereas the Master, you know, wears disguises for no reason and, you know, is the best thing in the Five Doctors, which is a story full of many, many best things, but he's absolutely one of the best things in it, because he's just glorious. And I, you know, and Anthony only scared me as a kid. I mean, I found him quite terrifying. But he, yeah, I think as a character, it's harder to accept the Master. The guy we saw in Time Flight is going to sit down and have a chat over brandy, you know, about Jekyll and Hyde or whatever.
He might do it in his Khalid outfit.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's an audio drama. Perhaps he's wearing his Khalid outfit throughout.
In every release.
Listen to it again.
I can see the Master that we see in Survival getting to this place.
Yeah.
You know, in the same way that I can see the Doctor that we see in Survival getting to this place. You know,
but I think that's Andrew Cartmell, isn't it? That's Andrew Cartmell going, if we're having the Master in it, he's got to be a serious character. He can still be terrifying, and he is terrifying in Survival, but he's actually got to have a very clear motive of what he is doing in that story, rather than just, we've got Anthony Ainley on a contract, so just bung him in, you know, bung him in a costume and
stick
reveal
him in
at
mask.
The end of episode three. Stick him in a mask. You know, I think, you know, Andrew Cartmell, you know, who I have so much respect for, he's sat there and gone, if we're doing a story about the Master, what is his motivation in this story? So Survivor is one of the few stories where I would say, argue, that he's got a very strong motivation, which is out to survive, which is, you know, I mean, it's such a stunning piece.
I think
of
that's one of Ainley's best performances as well. It brings out like a much more threatening take on his character.
Well, it's threatening, but also, even someone like him, who I never met him, but, you know, by all accounts, he just wanted to play cricket or something. Anybody like that And, you know, there are actors who, you know, I imagine do Big Finish now, who genuinely don't really care about Doctor Who. They're doing it because it's money, they're doing it because they get to see their friends and everything like that. But no matter how much they might be like that, you give them something like Survival, and you're like, oh yeah, this is why I act. You know, it's not just ripping off masks and being, you know, menacing. It's actually, I've got a proper character and I've got a thing of, you know, I'm seducing Midge. I could, you know, in previous stories, I could just hypnotise people. But there he's really got this sort of seducing thing going on, which is brilliant. You know, so yeah, I think Anthony Ennie is brilliant in that story because he's written as, you've got to do some acting. You know, you can't just be panto villain.
I feel like Sylvester is at his best when he's got good material as well. I think
he rises to the challenge. But I think any actor does. I think genuinely any actor, you give them, especially in something like Doctor Who or Dark Shadows. So Dark Shadows was a range I produced, and I'm thinking of an actress in that, Nancy Barrett, and she got to play all these different characters, and she's big and bright. She's brilliant. She's a great actress, and it's big and fun and all that. And we did a story where her character became an alcoholic in the audios, and her performance is absolutely astonishing. And I think it's the same with any actor, is they can have fun with parts of that, but there are times with Doctor Who or Dark Shadows or with any sort of that sort of, I mean, Star Trek The Next Generation, you know, the Star Treks do it, you know, sorry actor from Star Trek, for 20 episodes of this season you're standing there saying technobabble, but for one episode, or for one episode your parents are back, or the second episode everyone thinks you're dead, you know, you get an episode where you get to do the actual acting. And I do think that with you know, that happens a lot with somebody like Anthony Ainley, you know. Yeah.
Was that a conscious thing then with Jeffrey? Because I think it's interesting that if you it's 2003 now, and you say we're going to do a story with Omega, there's probably going to be some people who are like, oh, they couldn't get Stephen Thorne. Oh, that's a pity. Or like with Master, you kind of think, oh, Anthony Ainley, we can't get him anymore. You've got these two actors, you have done the role, but some would argue the story, not through any fault of theirs, you know, didn't give them a huge amount to do, or wasn't their finest hour. And with Omega, you've got obviously that weird tour de force performance there. And with Master, you know, you've got this absolute kind of throwing Jeffrey Beavers, who is unbelievably great, but the kind of giggling menace thing. But if you kind of throw him into a negative and you have this character, and you spend the whole time with this guy that you really like, and you kind of feel that you've got this kind of bubbling menace. And there are these moments where he kind of, you know, deliberately sort of toys with saying nasty, mean things. And that must have been quite a kind of pleasant shock for some listeners who are like, oh, we're incredibly lucky that Jeffrey Beavers is doing these. Mm. And he's gone on to just be the synonymous kind of Big Finish guy.
Yes, which is brilliant. And he's such a nice guy. But he... I remember just listening to Dust Breeding and being like, wow, what an amazing voice. I have seen The Deadly Assassin. Is it The Deadly Assassin he's in?
Oh, that's Peter Pratt, the other one? That one. Keeper of Charkin he's in.
Keeper of Charkin. So I have seen Keeper of Charkin, but he doesn't even do a lot in it, does he, really? No. You know, it's Dust Breeding was where I went, oh, that's a voice. That's brilliant. And that was one of the big moments in Big Finish history, the reveal of the Master in Dust Breeding, because, like, we had no idea. I had no idea. I was listening to it and just went, oh, right, okay, that's happening. But, yeah, so it was that. But also, actually, what it did do that was great was it gave me the chance to, although obviously you can't see the visuals, he looks hideous. And so actually what you have is you have a character who looks hideous, but isn't a bad person, is a good, very good person who saved a lot of lives. And you have him in, I love the idea of him being, again, I watched Ghostlight growing up, you know, that's imprinted on my brain. And it's very much that thing of seeing horrible things, but happening in a gorgeous Victorian wood panelled room, you know. And I think that was a big thing, being able to go, all right, for this character, he can say that he looks hideous. And then I'm so bad, I haven't listened to it in years. Has he had an affair with the woman?
Or does she fancy him? But she loves him.
She loves him, even though he looks awful. Which, again, I just quite liked that idea of doing something a bit unexpected in that way.
I have to ask, this is not really related to what you've just said, but was it in any way inspired by human nature? Because you've got a Time Lord who is out of their mind and called John Smith. That just tickled me halfway through. I suddenly thought, oh, it's quite like that. It's the Master's version.
No, I was given the fact that the Master had lost his memory. The Master was on an alien planet and he's lost his memory and it's Sylvester. That's what I was basically given. Because I think Cav Scott and maybe Mark Wright or maybe just one of them had been working on the idea and they'd had to drop out because they were doing one of the project stories. And so Gary asked me, because I'd done what he saw as good character work in The Rapture, which, as I say, was thankfully not yet released. So he knew that I would be someone he'd be interested in seeing what I would do with the character. So, yeah, no, it's funny because, I'd loved human nature. But hadn't crossed my mind at all. I think I just did John Smith because that was always the joke.
It does feel like a pointed joke at the Doctor's expense.
Yeah, he always calls himself John Smith. So I just thought, it would be funny. It would make sense for him to be called John Smith. Also, it's quite tricky, I think, coming up with a different name. I'm sure at one point I tried to do an anagram, but I couldn't do it. So it's quite tricky to sort of come up with a name that feels slightly iconic. You know what I mean? He can't. If he was just called Derek, he'd be like, all right, Derek, yeah, are you really the Master? Whereas John Smith comes with, for a Doctor Who fan listening to it, the loaded connotations of how the Doctor calls himself John Smith. You know, that's his fake name. And of course, I've just realised that. It's been 20 years. I've just realised, of course. So he's using the Doctor's name and he should have been the Doctor all along. That's clever. Well done. Nice. 20-odd-year-old me. That was quite clever.
You've done a Seventh Doctor. You've manipulated ahead of yourself.
Yeah, I have. I've juggled all the balls.
If you want, I can edit that bit out and we can pretend it was the plan all along.
No. Don't. I'm awful for it. I did a Tortured this year, it came out this year. And James Goss asked me at the recording, he did a little Q&A afterwards, and he said, so when did... And I was like, what do you mean? And he went, well, how the story does it. And I went, oh, I didn't realise it did that. I'm not necessarily the most intelligent of writers. I just write it and then I'm like, oh, yeah, that does make sense.
I suspect that's a running theme with Doctor Who, though. Like, a lot of the brilliant stuff is by accident.
By accident, totally, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Master is absolutely fantastic. It really does drill down on a character that, as you say, has never properly been explored. It's amazing, really, that this is the first proper exploration of that character. And giving him, you know, the role that you do, that John Smith persona. I really love that first episode where, like, the Doctor's hardly in it. He has a few lines at the start and then turns up for the cliffhanger, almost as if he's the villain of the story. Like, the cliffhanger
ending,
reveal. The cliffhanger reveal. Who's the villain?
That was
it's
my
the
thing
Doctor.
At that. Yes, that was definitely intentional at the time of going, he's when the Master turns up or the Daleks turns up.
Yeah.
This time it's the Doctor turns up because it's the disruptive force that's going to destroy the lives of these three quite nice people. I think they're probably not as nice as they seem, but, you know,
one of them's been doing a bit of murder. But
well, yes.
Yes.
But murders aside,
we don't know
he's quite a nice
point.
Bloke, yeah.
And again, fantastic bit of casting. Philip Maddock, wow.
Astonishing.
Yeah.
It was, and of course, sadly, you know, Philip and Anne have gone now, but I remember them being such a friendly cast. It was such a really nice recording. It was really hot, I remember that. But you had Jeffrey and Sylvester and Philip, all of whom were, you know, a good, I would say, 20 years older than, say, me, probably older than that. And then you had Charlie Hayes playing the maid stroke Death. And she was, I think she's younger than me. And I just remember it being so, like, she was, they all found her really sweet because she'd highlighted her lines in the script. Whereas they sort of like these old pros who had these stories to tell. And it was just a really, really lovely thing. And they really did that thing that I think I certainly took away from it as a writer, is Philip, I remember Philip, I was in the recording booth, I think, and he knew I was there, and he said, he made a very point of stopping and saying, I just want to say what a brilliant script this is. Which, you know, I think he was telling the truth, but it was that real thing that you learn from it of going, every writer and actor need, you know, it takes you 30 seconds to absolutely make their day and let them know that this is, you know, you're doing something good. And I think I really got that from him. So, I've done it with actors that I know and with other writers when I've script edited or produced or directed. It was just, you know, you learned so much from someone like Philip Maddock. Just an astonishing actor and an astonishing voice, and a really, really lovely man. So it was I don't even think at the time I realised what an honour it was I was writing for someone like Philip Maddock. I think I was just like, oh, great cast. You know, it's me in the Dalek film. You know, I don't think I was fully aware of actually what an amazing actor and he was and what a great career he'd had.
I think one of the best things I've ever heard Philip Maddock do is the audiobook to Alan Garner's Weird Stone of Brisingamen, which is sort of set around where I'm from.
Right.
But what a voice. Just brings it's a good book, but really, really brings something to it, really brings it to life. Master is just it's a drama full of voices to just die for, isn't it?
Yes, and astonishing.
It's one lucky, of the best collections of incredible audio voices there must be.
It feels like a play as well. I imagine that would have appealed to
a big part of it. A big influence on me was Amadeus, the Peter Schaefer play, because I'd done that at school and that was what made me really want to be a writer, because I'd done a lot of amateur dramatics and school plays and everything. But school plays tended to be, and I love them, but they tended to be musicals like Sweet Charity and The King and I and all sorts of things you probably wouldn't be putting on these days in a school. And then when we were in our sixth form, I didn't do the drama A level, even though I really wanted to. We couldn't make it fit with the other ones I did want to do. But I basically skived off lessons to take part in their A-level, their production of Amadeus, and I played Salieri in it. And I don't mean this as a bit of a brag, but I was great because I really got, like, my best mate played Amadeus, and his mum, who loved me, was like, I can't look at you right now. A year later, I was working on a supermarket checkout and someone said, oh my God, you gave me nightmares a year ago. But I realised what allowed me to do that was what a brilliant script it was. And I think that's when I realised, actually, acting isn't for me. What I want to do is not, you know, never have achieved anything like Amadeus, but to write something that gives actors good things to say and good things to perform. And I think with Master, there was that sense of it's effectively, you know, there's Amadeus, Mozart and Salieri, so there's two people, there's the master and the doctor, there's two people. So I think it takes a lot from that and that sort of classical vibe to it. But also it was me going, I want actors to really have good stuff to do. And I think, you know, that gives it more of a sense of it being a play, because, you know, all Doctor Who can't be like that. I mean, again, we were very lucky with the villains trilogies. I always say, you know, when people say the favourite Doctor Who story is Blink, I'm like, but it's not a Doctor Who story. It's it's brilliant because it's not a Doctor Who story, because it wouldn't work if it was a normal Doctor Who story. So, and it's the same with the villains trilogy. They work because we haven't, I was going to say lumbered, I love the companions, but we haven't got the companions in. So it allows us to push the boat out, or allowed us to push the boat out and do different things. And I think, you know, Master would have been very different. It wouldn't have had that play sensibility to it if it had heard Mel or Ace in it.
I think that really plays to the strengths of audio drama, because one approach is, okay, we're an audio, we can just like go crazy and have like an unlimited budget, and there's a place for that. I think it can work really well if it's like, you know, painting visual pictures. It's a skill in itself, but yeah, the ones that I remember, the ones that stand out, like Deadline is another one that you could just easily see being like transferred straight to like a stage production, and they're the ones that I think like really get inside your head as an audio drama.
And they're the, you know, they're the ones probably least like the old TV series, which we all love. But again, I suppose it's like what I said earlier on, I never really had any interest about trying to do that. Even though, say, I love the Davros story, because Davros, if you close your eyes, you are back. I am back to being whatever I was, 10 years old, watching Revelation of the Daleks. Because it's great because it captures that. And I love the fact that this world exists, where there are stories that really go for you are watching season 20. And then there are stories that just don't do that at all. And I think for me, the preference was to not to do that. And I think with Master, by not having a companion in, you know, Sylvester had never been without a companion. So to have him not have a companion allows a greater... there's more opportunity for it to be more like a play. So I was just very lucky and honoured to sort of get the opportunity to do it.
I think if Ace had been there, he would never have heard the end of it. She'd never let that one go.
I mean, I don't know. There was a version of Ace, you know, if you'd done the version of Ace like using Ghostlight, the quieter, angrier Ace, and maybe she's working in the kitchen with the maid and everything else. It wouldn't be as good. Not as good, that sounds egotistical, but it wouldn't be the same story. It'd be a very different thing, because also you'd want to give her agency, you'd want to give her something to do, and there really isn't room in that story for an extraneous character with nothing to do, which again, we were very lucky with the Villains trilogy, because by taking out the companion, it means you can really focus on that relationship between the two, the Doctor and the villain of the story, because you haven't got another character who you know, no writer worth their salt wants to have a character who isn't doing anything. So, you know, if you've got a companion, you want them to be an active and protagonist in the story.
Especially on audio, because you forget that they're there if they're not saying... Oh,
yes, I mean, absolutely. You know, that's such a big thing you have to worry about on audio is... I don't tend to worry about writing audio, but the one thing you do have to go is a character in a scene and they've not been mentioned so far, because it takes you out of the drama, because you go, have they been there all this time? I don't remember that, you know. So it's always... When I was script editing, it was always the note I'd always give is go, we don't know this person's in the scene. I don't know if they've been eavesdropping. I don't know if they're in the scene. I don't know if they're standing next to them. Go back and make sure we are aware when they come into the scene.
I think that just going back to what we were saying about, you know, the Doctor being on his own companionless, it's something that's been explored quite a lot since, like, the new series likes to do a Christmas special with the companion just stopping off elsewhere for a little while or that kind of thing. But it hadn't really been done at this point at all, had it? You know, we'd had the Deadly Assassin, and that was it for 26 years of Doctor Who, and I love the Deadly Assassin, it's fantastic. But it doesn't exactly take advantage of the fact that the Doctor's on his own beyond Tom Baker getting to talk to himself a little bit, which was the purpose of the exercise, I believe. But, exploring that idea in 2003 must have been quite... I suppose we'd done it in Sirens of Time, but apart from that, Sirens of Time is doing other things.
Yeah, Sirens of Time is just a big fun, look, we can do Doctor Who thing. Whereas I think the Villains trilogy, and it, you know, it all comes down to Gary Russell. The Villains trilogy is Gary going, we are celebrating the 40th anniversary of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
This is it. There is no TV celebration. We are the people celebrating the 40th anniversary of Doctor Who. What do we do? I don't want to do the Five Doctors again. Yeah. So let's give all three Doctors, the first three Doctors, a really strong character-led story that, again, I don't want to sound... You've got Nev Fountain and Lance Parkin. You've got two very distinct writers. You've got Nev, who, like you say, is basically Douglas Adams of our day, I would say. And you've got Lance Parkin, who is so entrenched in the New Adventures and what he did in New Adventures, which is astonishing. And then you've got me, who is a very new, young person, approaching it very much as I'm writing a story, not I'm writing a Doctor Who story. And I think what you end up then is three very distinct stories, rather than, let's just, you know, of Daleks, you know, and things like that, which I then think he then does in Zagreus by not having people playing the characters they are in the TV series. You know, it's just Gary going, let's actually creatively try something here that's a bit different to what people might expect.
I think some of the most interesting anniversary stories have been in extended media for Doctor Who, because I think there was The Scream of the Shaka that was the same time, but then like 5 years previously, one of my favourite books is The Infinity Doctors.
Which again does it does. It's a book. You could have all the you could do the eight Doctors again.
But is that Lance Parkin again?
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's it. He was, you know, him, Paul Cornell, and Kate Orman, and that were the, you know, the absolute defining voices, weren't they, of the New Adventures, and then the Eighth Doctor books. But you know, I think, you know, yeah, it's when it tries it something a bit different, which you can do partly because you're only trying to sell it to a fan audience. You know, you if you're doing a TV series to do the 20th anniversary of Doctor Who, you want to do the Five Doctors. That's what a general audience want. You want your mum sitting there going, oh, that's the one I used to watch, and, you know, and that. You don't want an analysis of the Doctor's relationship with Omega. that's not what my mum's going to sit down and watch. So I think that is that thing about the extended media, is because it's aimed at the fans, you have a bit more freedom to be less, you know, mainstream.
Which is why it's cool when extended media takes up that opportunity rather than do the Six Doctors and the Seven Doctors.
Because we don't need that. We've had that. We've had it a few times. And
I think it's diminishing returns, isn't it? I do think, you know, the first time the new series... I mean, I can proudly say I wrote the first appearance of the old Doctor Who's in the Sarah Jane Adventures that predated the Next Doctor. So I was the first one to do it, and then you had the Next Doctor, and it was amazing. And I think there is this, if you keep bringing them back, because you can bring them back, I mean, that's the thing, we know you can, it's a different world to how it was back in the day. You're dealing with actors who are probably retired now, so they will, you know, happily come back. Certainly on audio, you can record anybody at any time, you know. I did a Dark Shadows series, 13-part series. I think had about 40 speaking characters in it, none of whom acted together at all. Everybody acted separately. You know, you can do anything on audio, and to a certain extent, you can do that with TV a lot more now. You can just bring back anyone and do anything because it's not a multi-camera studio setup. So, you know, how can we get Fraser Hines and Wendy Pabry in on the same day when he's in Emmerdale and she's, you know, it's like you don't have to worry about that so much with the way that television is made these days. It's a lot easier to get someone in to do a cameo. But I do think it is diminishing returns, frankly. It's, look, there they are. You know, it's great.
Well, before we wrap up, because I'm aware we're running out of time, I suppose.
Yes, I've got to cook my dinner.
Yes, me too. This has led me to kind of one more question, actually, which was, how did we feel about what the 60th anniversary did, sort of bringing David Tennant back as a new Doctor? In terms of celebrating an anniversary, how did we feel about that? Because I know that there were kind of varying opinions of, this is absolutely amazing, it's great to have the old team back, and, oh, well, couldn't we have done something new, or couldn't we have got Sylvester McCoy in it, even though he was in Power of the Doctor year before, that kind of thing. So
I think Power of the Doctor kind of jumped the gun a bit.
It did, yeah. We kind of had the 60th on the 59th, didn't we?
Some of them, I think, thought they were in the 60th. but yeah, that one scratched that itch quite well, I thought. Yeah. But I thought the 60th stories were more kind of forward facing for me.
A bit more introspective than like this. Yeah, the Power of the Doctor had that Five Doctors vibe in a good way. I thought I liked it, but like I was sort of against it in principle when I heard he was coming back, because it's like, you know, let someone else have a go. And it was like, there's a video that emerged recently from his first era where he's like talking to a fan and going, oh, maybe in the future you could be the 14th Doctor. And then he came back and he was
the 14th
Doctor. But actually, I really liked that trilogy of episodes. I did like the full series as well, but I think I actually prefer that trilogy of specials. There's something that feels like coherent about them at the same time as they're like wrapping up arcs from like 10 years ago as well.
Yeah. I thought it was great fun. I think, you know, if it's difficult as a slightly older person, for me, David Tennant was just the Doctor about 2 weeks ago. You know, it seems odd him going back, but it's not. He's literally a generation ago. It's like if the old series had brought back Tom Baker, you know, who with no disrespect to any actor involved would be arguably the most popular Doctor, Tom Baker, and then David Tennant, they're not necessarily my favourite by any stretch of the imagination, but they would be the most popular one. It's a big news story. It gets people watching. But also, I think what it did brilliantly was he didn't just come back. She regenerated into him. And that was interesting. That's a story that never been done before. So I personally found it really, really, really interesting. And I loved the story on the spaceship that was just the Doctor and Donna. I thought that was a proper classic episode of Doctor Who. So worth it just for that one.
Absolutely. We kind of got a mini Russell T Davies series from the whole thing. We got the fun opener, we got the we got the midnight, the blink, the kind of different one, and then we got the big grand finale all in the space of 3 weeks, and that was kind of wonderful to have. And it was a really good, you know, there are sort of arguments, well, it doesn't celebrate all of Doctor Who. It's like, no, but it celebrates Doctor Who's success, and it celebrates one of its most successful eras.
Yeah, and it's doing something a bit different, which is...
Yeah, and it's brought back an actor who is just so intrinsically linked with the role that why the hell not, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I think we've broken the record for the longest episode of this podcast ever.
Oh, crikey.
we've passed an hour and a half. I don't think we've ever done that before. So this is probably a very good point to say some emotional goodbyes. So thank you so much for joining us again, Joe. It's been wonderful to talk about a very interesting part of Doctor Who history, actually. Sort of that, you know, how did we do the 40th when it wasn't on telly, that kind of thing. You know, we didn't have Dimensions in Time. We didn't have Day of the Doctor. So.
What a shame.
Can't believe I mentioned those two in the same sentence.
Dimensions in Time and talking about like classic anniversary stories.
I mean, that's a whole other episode, which you can come back and join us for if you want, Joe.
Yeah, I love Dimensions in
Time. So, yeah, thank you very much for joining us, Joe. It's been great to have you back on the podcast.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
It's been great to speak to you.
Yeah, big thank you to Gareth as well.
Thank you.
And a big thank you for Mansour for jumping on for the last half.
Thank you.
So we'll be back to talk about more Doctor Who, Big Finish, audio drama, all sorts very soon. But for now, it is goodbye. Thank you.